Good evening. Welcome to Smaller Narratives for a Larger World. I'm Alan Palacios, and I'm one of your three hosts. I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Jillian Canna, and Lauren Pierce. Jillian, why don't you tell us about Smaller Narratives?
Sure. Smaller Narratives for a Larger World is a new interdisciplinary iteration of the radio show project, Broadcasting World Literature, now featuring a variety of guests from academics and activists to creatives and practitioners. The podcast, which will run in its current form through the end of May, shares and discusses stories beyond what is conservatively categorized as quote-unquote literature to recognize their significance on both an individual and community level. This podcast is sponsored by four faculty in the Anthropology and Comparative Literature departments.
Yes. Also, we should mention who we are and our positions. So, as to me, I'm a Fulbright scholar from Argentina, and I'm a graduate student in the Comparative Literature Department.
And I'm Jillian Canna. I'm a graduate student studying English at Binghamton University.
And I'm Lauren Pierce. I'm an anthropology doctorate student here at Binghamton as well.
Perfect, thanks. So now we would like to sort of discuss what this project means to us and how we came together as a group participating in the project. Personally, I should say that I, in my field of study, take issue with oppression in all its forms, like those of sexuality, race, class. And I think that one way domination takes place is through language and narratives. But also within language, counter-hegemonic forces arise, and I'm always interested, more interested, in resistance possibilities. So my preoccupation is also directed towards critically thinking of, with, from smaller narratives that can create resistance to power. To give one example, last semester I organized a panel with Fulbright to discuss hegemonic Western and non-Western, non-dominant views around the concept of love as addressed by philosophers and literatures. And this departed from a question posed by a philosopher from my country. He says that he believes in a sort of critical activism of deconstructing idealizations because that's where the worst is played. He believes that suffrage and abuse is made out of the contradictions and anguish of people. So for me, that was a very provocative thought. And I also should mention that politically and symbolically, I think that the project is significant in a number of ways. First of all, we are embarking on a reality, right, which has many advantages. Jamie Keane, filmmaker and podcast creator, said, essays are not so popular as films, meaning academic writing can definitely exclude people sometimes. So engaging in this format of a podcast, which is a journey towards a reality, makes narratives more accessible. So we can bring stories, narratives, voices to broader audiences, right? Something that academic writing or just writing could not necessarily succeed in doing. In this sense, creating podcasts can be read as a more democratic act. And also another aspect of doing this project has to do with something that like ancient poetry and all forms of communication did, right? We have examples of indigenous peoples who in the American continent recorded past through memory instead of resorting to literacy. Or in the Western tradition, we can think of examples like Plato wanted the poets cast out of the city, or Ulysses in Homer had his ears covered from the voices of the sirens, right? This all show the dissident, seductive force of orality. So I believe this is a nice exercise of giving orality back an equally important role in the sharing of stories, histories, works. So as such, it's a great place for engaging in conversation.
Yeah, thanks for sharing, Alon. I would really like to second everything you've said there. So I study women's online self-representation, and with that being said, storytelling is totally at the core of what I do. Because as you mentioned, there's certainly a form of resistance when we do give voices to those we either study or discuss issues involving. So I feel that I was drawn to this project because storytelling is especially important when I do. And going back to what you said about academic writing, there's definitely a way in which it often excludes these populations that we're discussing or that we may even be part of. And so I find that, at least in my research, I conducted quite a few different interviews with a bunch of different women to kind of ask them about their perceptions about what online identity looks like for them and what kind of factors and other contributing influences may shape and mold those identities. And so I find that platforms such as a podcast or other ways in the digital sphere that we express these academic interests are pretty beneficial to conversation as a whole in order to include everyone. So, yeah, Lauren, what do you think?
I think it's interesting that you mention academic interests and, Alon, that you talked about kind of reality. Especially within, like, the academic sphere, we talk a lot about people being students or at school, and then once they get out in the real world, real world in air quotes here, and that kind of is dissonant with the fact that academic interests are part of the real world. So part of this podcast is really looking at how those aren't separate, and how, like both of y'all mentioned, it's making sure that the stories that we're sharing through these modalities and the voices that have access to these modalities are representative of kind of that holistic view there. But my background's a bit circuitous, I would say, because as y'all know, I'm a student of anthropology here, but I got my master's in education and community development. And before that, I worked in law enforcement, and I found that through all of those, stories are always key. They might just be told in different ways. In education, you know, we tell stories to students, or even for community development, it's all about people being able to share their stories. It could be participatory action with minors. So children or teenagers being able to share their stories because they have valid insights. Age isn't necessarily related to validity there. It could be about reframing stories for certain purposes. So for a legal purpose, you have to tell a story a certain way, and that can be really invalidating in and of itself. So a lot of this, we see these separation between these things, which is why I think that this interdisciplinary look at smaller narratives within a larger world, smaller narratives for a larger world being, you know, the literal title here, is key to this kind of mission with this podcast going on here. But if we pick apart the title a bit more, I think it kind of elucidates some more ideas that we are going to explore this season. This season we're planning on having a pretty broad spectrum of people to interview and talk about their experiences and their work and, of course, their stories. But if we pick apart the title, so we have smaller narratives for a larger world, we're looking here at narratives, and we keep repeating the words narrative and storytelling, which might be a bit pedantic, but is a common thread here through this conversation, right? Through this story we're making in and of ourselves right now. And we're talking about kind of narrative is making manifest the latent consciousness of interconnectedness of both past and present identity and space. So the potential for stories and narratives, kind of using those words synonymously right now, for bringing forward ideas that we're maybe not aware of on a very forward level. And then kind of using narrative in and of itself as a knowledge modality, which can extend beyond didacticism. So extending beyond this teaching orientation, right? So stories as being able to show, not only tell. I think we can all think of a time or a place when a novel or a textbook or anything like that was trying to tell you about a situation or tell you about the application of something important. So, you know, for instance, I was just reading about trauma-informed care, and they were trying to describe how important it is, the author there, and it was just on a website online, and they ended up using a vignette. And you could tell that they had realized at some point in that telling a short story was going to convey that a lot better, that show rather than tell why you should care about it. And I think that's where podcast or audio here becomes multifunctional. It captures tone, it captures pitch, pause. It can capture sound decay. So, you know, how long it takes the sound to kind of slide out versus a very abrupt stop there. And it can really see audio, music, or voices as representative of emotion. And I don't know the history of literature very thoroughly, but I think it has an interesting application when we think of written word as an adaptation for recording and sharing spoken word. And here I like to think about a book by Dr. Goman. It's Mark My Words, Native Women Mapping Our Nation. So it's about cartography. But she says that while narratives and maps help construct and define worldview, they are not determined and are always open for negotiation. So Alon and Jill, when y'all were both talking about bringing stories into spaces that they might not have necessarily had access to before, I think that really is building on that idea of this being a negotiation, right? That that stories are still applicable and they can still change things, that they aren't set in stone, and these larger cultural ideas aren't set in stone either. And I think to wrap that up a bit, why podcast specifically is great for storytelling here, other than really getting back to these roots, is that it has this intrinsic tie to the legitimization of knowledge production and consumption. So when we think about consuming knowledge, so intaking knowledge and producing knowledge, a lot of the times, especially as academics and students and instructors, we think about writing and publishing papers. We think about assigning papers and books to our students. We think about consuming books and papers as students. But you know, storytelling and speaking even just with each other is certainly a legitimate form of kind of knowledge modality and a form of consuming and conveying that. And then you have to think about what kind of role the teacher often has, and that's often a lecture, right? Or it's a seminar where people are really talking to each other, that kind of Socratic seminar style. And I think that kind of pulls into, if we want to get away from this academic context, this kind of low-level debate that you see going on pretty regularly, which is, are audiobooks like really a type of reading? So, you know, if you're online and you're on Goodreads and you're kind of watching yourself and others and seeing how many books you've read that year, you're talking with someone who's kind of bragging about how many books they've read. If you say, I've read this many, but so many of them were audiobooks, that's thought of as like cheating. Like it doesn't count as real reading. And there's a dismissiveness to that. There's kind of a delegitimization going on there. And we know actually that's not necessarily the case intrinsically. And we can see that audiobooks are incredibly important for access to stories, right? So, you know, people who have migraines or vision issues can access audiobooks a lot easier. You can multitask with audiobooks. So if you're busy, you know, if you're a single parent and you don't have time to just sit down and read a book, you can do it while you're doing your chores. And we see that, you know, stories aren't necessarily, I think, something that need to be or at least should be legitimized here. So I think we're really getting back to the basics of stories being spoken, right? And of being able to capture a lot more with that spoken word than we could on paper, despite how many tools we've developed over the centuries to try to, right? We have our semicolons and our ellipses, and we're trying so hard to do that. And, you know, if you receive a text message in all caps, it kind of feels like you're being yelled at. But that really, as far as I can tell, seems to serve as a way to capture spoken words. So here we are kind of getting back to basics almost, except I say that surrounded by a studio full of like high-tech equipment that I couldn't even begin to understand. So basics in a very complicated physical context.
Okay, thanks, Lauren. Thought on something that you said that I could add. So you spoke about negotiation and legitimacy, and I was also thinking that the name of this, the title of this project also sort of advocates for plurality, you know? So we're speaking of advocating for a plurality of non-dominant narratives, right? Many, right? Narratives. In this way, this allows for... this implies that we support the idea there are many ways of representing ourselves, resignifying our worlds, our dwellings, our relations, right? As opposed to something pretty hegemonic and monolithic, right? So I think the title, calling it Smaller Narratives for a Larger World, makes a lot of sense because of this idea of plurality.
Yeah, for sure. And thinking about smaller narratives in the context of resistance to this hegemonic sort of influence, at least to take my work, for example, I like to examine these narratives that women are given, these idealized versions of what woman means, and to see on Instagram, for example, how do women replicate this, or how do they manipulate this or even counter that? And so it might not even necessarily mean that it's always a smaller narrative, but sometimes it's just overlooked or frequently goes unrecognized. And so these narratives, whether they're smaller or larger in a smaller or larger world, through the examination of these narratives, we can kind of parse apart what is given to us that we are supposed to either replicate in the way we identify ourselves or represent ourselves, and also how we counter that. And that's just really interesting to see the ways in which people do and how they kind of file into this category of small, though they're doing so much work and they're extremely powerful.
Well, and it's interesting you say that because, like you were getting at, we wouldn't ever want to insinuate that any of the narratives, especially any we would invite to be on the show, are going to be small, right? And nobody's story, nobody's life, nobody's experiences, nobody's fictional stories in their heads are ever small, but perhaps more it's the place that they're given and the space that they're given is small. Or, you know, given might even be a euphemism. Perhaps the better term is allocated here, right? So part of this idea is allowing more space or you know, making space, making place and space and identity room here for narratives. And then we can kind of jump from looking at the word smaller to what we're talking about here with the larger world, which is perhaps made larger by a lot of stories that don't necessarily fit into a single narrative, right? So we're looking at multiple narratives, which, Jill, I'm sure you see a lot with when you're analyzing kind of the alternate narratives that are going on continuously and very parallel to each other, though perhaps not parallel in content when you're looking at these online conversations and online representations of self.
Yeah, completely. And it's interesting to see at least the identities that are reproduced in a sense, because we think about larger trends that we either see in pop culture or just, you know, these, again, idealized narratives that are given to women. There's certain paths that you're given to choose, and it's your choice to decide which that you'll take. And so there's definitely some tension, or yeah, I would say tension between the two, because, you know, choice and this free will is kind of iffy, because we often feel obligated to one path, or we feel as though, I don't know, I would say, yeah, I guess just obligated to kind of pursue one identity over another in these narratives. But in re-examining these narratives, we can kind of decide, you know, after reading those, we can dismantle their value, or maybe rewrite what they mean for future generations. And this goes for other vulnerable populations as well that we may study in the academic world.
Yeah. Sorry, Alan, you go ahead.
No, you go, please.
So, Jill, does that have to do a lot with also the narratives and the narratives as they represent someone's identity needing to be cohesive? So you have to have like a really singular plot line that you tell about yourself, and it's a single identity and it can't really be multimodal. You're kind of a victim, or you're not, or you're a woman, or you're not effeminate. Is that anything that you've seen?
Yeah, I would say that I find that these identities are often fragmented, especially in like a super cross-cultural kind of world that we're in. There's a lot of cultural crossing, at least, but that it also turns into borrowing and appropriation. And that's one facet of my research that's become super interesting, is seeing this sort of stealing between cultures, especially on the part of white people. And so we find that some people on social media become really popular and capitalize and then profit off of adopting these characteristics from cultures that just aren't their own. And we often see no homage paid to those cultures. And so it comes to this capitalist and consumerist notion that, you know, the group that should be kind of embodying these characteristics and reaping the reward thereof aren't. And so that's something I focus on a lot, is because these fragmented identities, we see a picking and choosing of what people want to be. And while some of that I feel isn't necessarily a cognizant choice or conscious choice, but it's sort of just following this, you know, mainstream allure to some traits and some trends over others.
Thinking about fragmented identities, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because sometimes there could be a tension, I think, between what is considered a fragmented identity and then an identity that doesn't need to be like that. Sometimes this comes more as an imposition in some instances, which is placed on certain vulnerable populations, so as to prevent them to recollect themselves and resist and re-exist, you know, to experience their lives like outside of oppression. It's as if you imagined a broken mirror. If the only image that you see of yourself is a distorted one, then it's hard to believe that you can be something else than that image. And I think there is, we can think of a tension between the need for the fragmentation to be imposed, right, by hegemonic forces and thinking. Do you have something to say about that, Jillian?
Yeah, totally. At least in my work, I would just like to identify what these forces are that I'm talking about. Just talking about patriarchy, we're talking about beauty norms, we're talking about just an array of those sort of icky things. And so, yeah, they're totally part of the, they're totally part of these fragmented identities and this imposition onto either women or other vulnerable populations.
Exploring a lot of that as we get into this season, and all of our interviewees. We have a website forthcoming, but you'll be able to find our recordings as well on the ORB. That's the Open Repository at Binghamton, and you can find that at orb.binghamton.edu. Thank you so much for tuning in and staying with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome. This is a continuation, or rather second part of us introducing our podcast. It's Smaller Narratives for a Larger World. I'm Lauren Pierce. You're here with Alon and Jill, and we're all in the studio. We talked briefly about the podcast itself, and we wanted to get a little bit more into our backgrounds and ourselves so you kind of understand who you're talking with, or at the very least, who you're listening to. And I'll go ahead and start with myself. So I've said that I'm a doctoral student here at Binghamton in sociocultural anthropology. I have a background in education and community development and action, and a background in law enforcement. A lot of what I do is centered around racism and neocolonialism. I think we can tell that came pretty directly out of that background in law enforcement, as far as that activism around racism goes. I've had a lot of research focus in racism, specifically against indigenous peoples in international development research, within the hierarchies in academia itself. And I'm currently working on sexual harassment and sexual assault within academia and the sciences. So Jill and I have a lot of overlap there with her research on kind of activism and representations for women as well. And interestingly, we've all kind of described ourselves within our career and academic selves, but it's pretty hypocritical on my part. I always tell my students that their self-identity should extend beyond just them within their education, so themselves as students or themselves within their career. We know that's pretty unhealthy as well mentally. So I feel like all that we've told y'all is specifically about us within ourselves as students and within our careers. So I'm going to offer up a couple operational beliefs of mine that are outside of that and are perhaps... All right. So one of those operational beliefs is that technology problems follow me, as you might be hearing right now. But we're back and the microphone should be working and I should not be leaning around quite as much. But another one of those is a belief that dogs belong in every educational setting, and particularly my dog, Trace, who is an excellent TA. And if you've ever had him as your TA, you should wholly agree, I assume. And then a third there is that memes are a wholly underrated means of group therapy. You will never feel like the world has the same troubles as you do and so connected as when you see a meme about it scrolling past your page online. So those are a few of my core beliefs in life that are perhaps outside of academia and outside of my career that I hope will extend that identity beyond everything we've just described as hegemonic. What about you, Alon?
Okay. So as I have already mentioned, I am new to this country. So this is my second year. And before I came here, I didn't even know snow. So, and it snowed today for the first time. And today is, a wonderful day to start. As to my background, yes, from very early on in college, I became interested in literatures from Anglophone countries, English-speaking countries, that is, former colonies. I got interested in hearing, learning what those texts, those voices about which were outside the canon had to say. The canon is, I think, one of those problematic concepts and materializations of hegemony in education, for instance, when we go to school, at least in my country, and when you go to college too, usually syllabi are designed following canon, a specific canon, a specific number of texts, and those texts sometimes have very, to me at least, conservative ideas about the world, very close perspectives, and as I felt quite uncomfortable with that because it didn't represent reality, as we spoke about reality, Lauren, before. So that also kept impulsing me to like look elsewhere for, you know, other perspectives. So that's one thing that sort of marked my start in the academia, we can say. After that, I became engaged with people who were doing activism, especially people who were doing LGBTQ activism. You know, they were fighting for their rights. My country is known for being one of the first countries to have passed a law for same-sex marriage. We have a gender identity law and several other progressive laws. So so I sort of became also involved in the academia at the time in which all of this was happening, and sort of became like a conversation between what I was reading and what was happening around me. And another project that I was a part of was Literatures of the South. It was the first attempt to communicate among countries of the Southern Hemisphere. Until then, there used to be this problematic circulation of texts through Northern editorial houses, which sort of decided what texts were going to be published, let's say, in South Africa by Argentine authors. And that felt, you know, not right to have this sort of triangular circle and having other people who were not part of the South deciding what authors are read, what stories are told, what voices are heard, right? So that's another important point of inflection, I should say, in my career, in my background.
And Ilan, how do you see podcasts like this or this podcast fitting within or without of the canon you were speaking about?
Great. Yes, I definitely think that we are advocating for inviting, having people talk about stories that you would definitely not find included in the canon, for sure. For instance, one of our upcoming guests, the guest who has confirmed to be in our second episode, Monica Surmuk. She is an Argentine feminist scholar. And one of her works, her current work, her current research has to do with recovering stories and memories of children who were disappeared or abducted. I don't know the right word in English. Sorry about that. So, which is something that happened during a very totalitarian period of in my country, which was the dictatorship in 1976. So, for instance, this is a very unusual type of research, you know, and this is definitely non-canonical. And I think the guests that we are thinking of inviting to share their narratives are usually people who are outside this canon.
So for our listeners who might not be aware, can you define what canon is?
Maybe we should ask that from Harold Bloom, who is renowned person, expert, who defines the canon and advocates for having a canon in literature, where Shakespeare is number one, the number one author to be read. I think what I could very quickly say about the canon, and then I will move, we will move to Gillian because I don't want to take so much time. So the canon, it has to do with, it has a prescriptive nature, a prescriptive conceptualizing or, yeah, conception. So the idea is that there exists in the world a number of texts, of literary texts that must be read by everyone. So, for example, Shakespeare. There are some problematic presuppositions underlying there, because there are beliefs that the themes, for instance, that a very interesting author, of course, like Shakespeare, portrays in his writing are universal. That is, what he talks about can be relates to everyone. It's something that everyone can identify with. And to give you just one small example, when you read, if I'm not mistaken, The Tempest, one of his very famous plays, which actually is his last play before he died. So in this text, you see one of the characters trying to make a fire, you know, this story is about a couple of people stranded, cast away. They are stranded in an island in the Caribbean. And when we read it for the very first time in college, I remember we burst into laughter, because how can someone say that they want to build a fire in the Caribbean, right? And there you have an example of a completely misunderstanding of other realities, presupposing that what you know, your reality, encompasses everything, every other reality in the world. I hope that works for an explanation of the canon.
Yeah, totally. And I'd actually like to build on that, at least in relation to our show. So, especially when you mentioned Shakespeare as sort of this canonical figure, it's really interesting. We're talking about looking at these literary and cultural narratives and sort of examining those and seeing, hey, what does this say? What does this say about us? What does it say about who wrote it, etc.? And shout out to my professor, David Sterling Brown, who I took Shakespeare with when I was an undergraduate English major. We read plays such as Othello and these canonical texts that had pretty racist undertones, actually. And these are narratives that are frequently not spoken about when we think about Shakespeare and things of that nature. And so sort of to bring it back, it's, you know, you can take canonical texts and more literary texts and still find these sort of elusive themes embedded within them. And they're definitely really powerful and worthwhile to take a look at. And so, yeah, that was just to sort of think about the canon in terms of what we would like to do here.
And you mentioned worthwhile to take a look at here, which brings me back to the applicability of your work specifically, Jill. So you have a background in literature, and right now you're looking at specifically representations and self-representations of women. Can you explain that a little bit more to us?
Yeah, of course. And I'll be the first to say I'm not the best at explaining it. But just to walk everyone through a little bit, this will help me. So as a senior last year, I double majored in English and Spanish. And for my senior thesis, I wrote about this topic, women's online self-representation, because it was something that has actually interested me for years. I would notice these things on Instagram because Instagram came out around when I was like 13 or 14. So in a sense, I did grow up with this platform, and watching it evolve and seeing how important it became to me and how I viewed myself and how I noticed other women specifically were kind of taking into account what Instagram meant for them and their own identities. I was kind of scratch my head one day, and I was like, this might actually mean something a little bit bigger than, you know, just some silly desire for likes and followers. This actually might mean something more. And so really engaging with critical race theory and third wave and now becoming fourth wave feminism, kind of getting a better understanding of what's going on here beyond just when we think about self-esteem and beauty norms, but also what's going on in terms of our race and gender politics, because I feel as though when we look at how we portray ourselves online, it's often a reflection of what's going on in, you know, the larger world, to take our title, for example. So, yeah.
Can I ask, Lauren, can I ask you a question about maybe your field and if you could think of it in terms of our project? Like, anthropology, right? We know anthropology is a science, right? And it has been thought of sometimes having also a problematic way of, from, you know, my experience with it, from what I read, like in my background, of sometimes sort of misrepresenting or sort of eclipsing the people that they are trying to help. Like if you have an anthropology going to, you know, an indigenous community, and then there is this thing about them sort of arrogating them, their story, or because it's sometimes it's thought of as engaging in a relationship which is more subject-object. And I think that's a thing that maybe if we think of smaller narratives and anthropology, I'm speaking, you know, from a very outsider experience here, but I think it's something very interesting that to me has potential from someone who has, you know, this idea.
Yeah, well, so that's a very, very heavy background with that. And it's interesting. I've often had it described to me by people who've been in this field much longer than I have. And I've certainly been in a few different fields and would probably say that I am in a few different fields currently. I kind of feel like I'm at one of those 4 points, like crossovers where the states are, and you just have like a hand and a foot in each section, like Twister style. But with anthropology, there's definitely that big history of a very colonial intentions, colonial actions, really taking stories rather than sharing them necessarily, doing research on someone rather than research with someone. And a lot of the statements coming out of it now come from acknowledging that background, which is interesting to see because it's definitely still in place and still very noticeable today. But at the same time, you have a lot of people who are probably more aware of it because they come from a discipline that has that background. And so they kind of think about that every day as a way to move away from it and fix that, which is certainly what interested me, was coming into this place that has such a history and maybe being able to use it to unravel that. And I think it's important to acknowledge that that's not just a history, it's a present. And we often describe things as being okay for the time period, but not okay now. But it's also important to say that they were never okay. that kind of research, that kind of treatment of anyone, that kind of working with anyone or working on rather than with, certainly was not okay at any point. But it, I think it brings an interesting context when you're trying to position yourself within that field. And certainly I mentioned I have a background in law enforcement and criminology. And so it's something I'm used to, operating within a field that has heavy, heavy issues with those kinds of things and heavy issues with representation and race and very colonial aspects to its structure. And very purposefully for myself, trying to go into those spaces and negotiate them in a way that's decolonial, which sometimes works and some of the actions don't work. It's certainly a tighter fit. You know, it's not like going into fields and areas that are already very kind of decolonial in the way they operate and very aware of the trauma, the personal trauma, the kind of genetic memory trauma, all of those types of things that comes with that. So it does, it makes for an interesting orientation, but I also think it makes for an interesting orientation for the show as well. As we talk to people both in fields with that background and in fields that perhaps don't have as much of a heavy background in that, and can talk to them about their processes, because certainly not everyone uses the term decolonial, but a lot of the creatives and the academics and the activists that we'll be talking to have operations in that way. So it will make it interesting to see how the terminology may change, but those orientations don't necessarily change, because a lot of the terms that you use and a lot of the terms that Jill used are not necessarily the same as might be used in anthropology, but certainly have similar, if not the same, meaning.
Absolutely. I totally second what you're saying, especially about the history of anthropology and its current its situation, right? Something that I could add to what you just said is that that the podcast project is offering an opportunity, again, through orality, to listen to the voices, to the narratives. And that's something quite, let's say, anti-canonical or non-hegemonically anthropological, right? Just letting them, you know, share and tell us and you know, putting ourselves, in the service of those who want to share their stories, their narratives. So I think that's a great thing, you know. And I think this maybe could be also thought of as a decolonial gesture on our part.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably more than a gesture as well. One helps agility. What are your ideas around kind of that decolonial orientation?
Yeah, and just to conclude, because we only have a couple minutes left here, I totally want to second everything you've both said in terms of how that decolonial sort of idea or goal totally goes hand in hand with what our show is and what we want it to be in terms of recognizing our own position as within an institution. There's a privilege with that, but we want to make sure that we are able to amplify and give space to other voices as well as our own. And because our own interests and our sort of desires and our own goals will naturally flow, but I think in conjunction with those other voices is what makes this show, or what I hope will make this show, really special for all of us and everyone who wants to join, and as well as our listeners.
Yeah, for sure. So thank you to you all who've kind of occupied this space with us. If it's been for the previous episode over the break, or that one and this one, or just this one, thank you for tuning in and sitting here with us. Again, this has been Smaller Narratives for a Larger World. It's a podcast that will be available on the ORB, the Open Repository at Binghamton, and can be found at orb.binghamton.edu.